Thank you very much. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here tonight and speak about the dark side of solar energy. Yeah, my name is Sébastien. As the colleague said, I'm interested into embedded systems, hardware, but also high voltage and big sparks, and also what is called operational technologies, OT, like power plants. Yeah, and the question for today is decentralized energy production, green future, or cybersecurity nightmare. And in particular, we will see what could happen if we shift the control of our electricity production system to some clouds. And December is the best time to speak about solar energy and cybersecurity. We still have time to patch until the sun is strong again. Okay, so the agenda, I will say a few words about context and motivation. Then we will deep dive into the research results, especially on one device. We will see vulnerabilities, an exploit chain, and one or two POCs. And then we will extend the results to some other devices in a kind of survey. We then discuss about open source solutions available, regulations, and then conclude. I'd like to say thank you to my friends Davin, Dimi, Ganda, and Julian for their support, to Andrian from Heise, to the BSE, and of course to the Chaos Computer Club. Now, our energy production system, our electricity production system, is transitioning from fossil fuel-based to renewable, that for sure. At the same time, it's also transitioning from a centralized system, few big power plants on the left side of this slide, to a decentralized system, many, many smaller power plants, which are also connected. And this applies especially for solar energy, which is, as per nature, distributed. A few numbers. In Germany, we had this year over 300,000 so-called balcony power plants in operation. And overall, we have 2.6 million solar power plants in Germany with a capacity of 70 gigawatts. Now, to emphasize that solar energy plays an important role in our energy mix, in our electricity, here is the picture from energy charts. And this is that in peak time, I mean, it's in summer, right? Light summer, in midday, more than 60% of our electricity productions come from photovoltaic. Now, from a cybersecurity perspective, it is simpler to protect the castles, the big power plants, than the tiny houses on the right, the smaller power plants. On the left, you can add some lines of defense, you can separate the network easier. And on the right side, the device has to be simple, cheap, and on the other side, they are also connected, right? That's the cybersecurity challenge. Now, let's have a look at a typical small solar power plant. We have on the left side of this slide, you see the solar panels, which produces the or transforms the solar energy into electricity, the photovoltaic effect. And it feeds the energy, the DC current, into a device called inverter. And this inverter transforms this energy into grid-compatible energy and feeds it into the grid. Now, if we stop here, nothing happened, we can go home, there is no cybersecurity problem. But mainly, these devices are connected. And the vendors, they provide some connectivity device, Wi-Fi stick, you name it, either external or internal in the inverter. And these devices are connected to your home router, which is then connected to the internet. The connectivity device acts as a client and connects to the cloud servers of the vendor. And they are using WebSocket, Modbus TCP, or Rho TCP, MQTT. I saw everything there. On the right side, as an owner, you can access the data of your power plant via an app or on your smartphone or a web client. Both app and web client are communicating via some APIs with the cloud servers. And here, unfortunately, I have the first buzzword of this presentation, which is the IT-OT convergence. But that's very simple, right? On the left side, you have OT. On the right side, you have IT. And they are just merging together. That's all. Now, these inverters, they have also remote functions that you can access via the API. The first one and most important one is to fetch energy and power data. That's what you want to see on your smartphone and show your friends or whatever. But there are more functions. You can also remote control your power plant. You can switch it on. You can switch it off. You may be able to change parameters depending on the vendors, limit power, or whatever. There is also this remote maintenance. no idea, some installer could maybe access your power plant and do stuff. And last but not least, there is the remote firmware update. And you know firmware update is important. It's double edged, right? It's important on one side to have firmware update in order to be able to patch vulnerabilities, obviously. But on the other side, if you do not implement it properly from a security perspective, then you may get into trouble. And that's what we'll see in this presentation. OK, out of curiosity, I had a look at four different systems, so inverters plus cloud connectivity, from four different manufacturers, from the balcony class, which is the smaller devices, to the rooftop class, bigger devices. And now I will present detailed results about the OMILES microinverter HM300 with a DTU light. So remember these acronyms, MI for microinverter and DTU, which is the connectivity device. I have one here. And I will use these acronyms in the rest of this presentation. So we will see vulnerabilities, POC, and so on. For the remaining three devices, I will present in a kind of survey some anonymized high-level results. A few lines of disclaimer. So the cloud vulnerabilities have been patched by now and very fast by the manufacturer. I did test on my own inverters, obviously. I had no external financing. By the way, if you are interested in buying some used inverter, right, I have a lot at home, and so you can talk to me after the talk. I didn't find any PCert, product cert, responsible disclosure policy at the vendor side. Who needs that, right? So I informed the BSE beginning of September. And the manufacturer had access to the main part of my report end of September. And Heise published three excellent articles about this research end of September, so this is public knowledge. And they could reproduce most of the exploits too. You see the articles on the right side, and they are still available. OK, now let's have a look at the vulnerabilities of the device. We begin with the simple one, information disclosure. Missing authorization in an API allowed an attacker to extract serial numbers of all connected inverters and connectivity devices. So here, when you create a new power plant, you will get a kind of ID in integer. And each time a power plant is created, this integer will be just increased by 10. So this is quite simple to enumerate. And just with the knowledge of this ID, it was possible to extract the associated serial numbers of the MI, the inverters, and the DTU, the connectivity device. And we found 230,000 plants as of September 2023, this year. And this is how it works. It's quite simple. The API is very simple. You need a session token, but you can create a new account and take a session token from this new account. It doesn't need to be related to the ID of the power plant. And again, since there is a pattern behind the ID generation, you can also enumerate it. And on the right side, you see the serial numbers of the devices related to this ID. Second vulnerability, command any device. Due to an insecure direct object reference vulnerability, commands could be sent to any connected device with a simple account. Only the serial number was needed. Now, this is a very critical one, right? Because with this one, so there is a list of commands. We will see a few of them. And basically, anybody could execute command on any device just by knowing the serial number. That's not very good. And this is how it worked. Here is an excerpt of the command list. You see reboot, upgrade, reboot, shutdown, limit power, upgrade again. So interesting comments from an attacker perspective. And in the middle, you see an example of an update command to a DTU. So again, we need a session token, but we can create a new account and take this session token from this new account. It doesn't need to be related to the devices. We need the serial numbers, but we saw in the last slides how to get all serial numbers of all devices connected. And interestingly, as an attacker, we also control part of the URL from which the device will fetch its update image. And that's very important. And this URL is relative to the update file server, to the official update file server from the vendor. Third vulnerability, upload a firmware file. Due to lack of sanity checks, a firmware update image could be uploaded to the cloud server. Due to server misconfigurations, this file was also accessible via the official update server domain name. Now, this is a funny one, because in that case, You know, the vendors, they are providing a nice feature to upload an image, a picture, because image is misleading in that case, a picture of your power plant to the cloud, right? But you could also upload more than a picture. You could upload also an update image, so a binary. It's not really a binary because it's in Intel Hex format, but anyhow, it was possible to upload an Intel Hex update image to the cloud. And then, interestingly enough, this was also accessible via the firmware update server name, domain name. And this is how it works. Here, for the upload command, no need for session token, interestingly. In the file contents, you see that this is the typical multi-part form data stuff. So you put image PNG so that the server say, OK. And then you put your Intel Hex format, so the update image you want to upload. And you get a success message with a file path, relative file path. And this file is also accessible via the official firmware update domain. And we come to the last one, fourth vulnerability, manipulate a firmware update image. Firmware update images were not signed, and Secure Boot was not in place. Therefore, a manipulated firmware update image could be crafted and therefore installed. So we have two devices. We have the DTU, and we have the inverter, the MI. OK, it's not really, but anyway. And for both devices, the firmware is divided into a bootloader and an application part. The bootloader is probably not updatable, but we can update the application. And they put a lot of checksums and CRCs, but no cryptographic protection. And now we have all the steps, all the elements for our exploit chain. I think you understood it. We will craft a manipulated firmware image with shellcode for the DTU and for the MI. We will upload these firmware update images to the upload server. You remember, we can upload a picture, but you can also upload a binary. And then we will command any devices, basically, to install these images because of the IDOR vulnerability and because we can get all serial numbers of all connected devices. With that, we have a kind of mass, but cheap, remote code execution via firmware update process. The goal of this shellcode here in my examples would be to synchronously manipulate multiple devices. And the first example will be to toggle the grid side relay at a predefined time. And then I will explain the steps. But other behaviors could be programmed too. And I have a second video for a second POC. The challenge for the shellcode, obviously, is to only extend but to not disturb the normal operations of the device. These are the setup I used. On the left, you see the wall setup with the MI, so the inverter in the middle, the DTU on the right. On the left side, I connected the grid side to a small signal generator, not to the real grid. And it is monitored by an oscilloscope. The solar side is connected to a power supply because the electronics is powered by the solar side. So the power supply simulates the solar panels, let's say. On the right side, you see the setups used for shellcode development for the DTU. If you open it, you see this PCB. And there is a JIDAG interface, which is open. And on the bottom, you see the inverter, the MI. Here, I had to remove all this kind of compound. They put the PCB in the case and put a lot of black metal. I don't know what it is, but it was a mess, and it is still a mess, sorry. And yeah, I had to remove that. But the PCB is there, and there is also a JTAG, which is obviously also open. And so I could develop the shellcode. OK. The DTU implements a Giga device, GD32. Maybe you know it. It's an ARM-based CPU with embedded flash. I used Ghidra for shellcode development in assembly, and I debugged with Jalink. The DTU has an RTC, so a real-time clock. And you see on the left of the left top of the picture, you see a small battery. So there is an RTC and a backup battery. And the RTC will be synchronized with an NTP server. So we have a time base. And I use this time base to stop the DTU firmware at a predefined hard-coded time, like a time bomb. For that, I extended the watchdog reload interrupt. And in this interrupt, I will compare the actual time in RTC with the hard-coded time, and if the time is reached, then all interrupts will be stopped, and the device will go into an endless loop and switch on all LEDs. That's important. Here you see some excerpt of the shellcode. On the left, the reload watchdog function, which has been patched. And here you see an unconditional branch to this mypatch function on the right. This mypatch function will do the steps I said before, so compare the RTC with the hardcode in time and eventually go into this forever loop. On the MI side, it was a little bit more complicated. Here we have a TI DSP with a kind of exotic core, this C28X, also embedded flash. I didn't find any decompiler support, so I used the TI compiler for shellcode development and also the TI environment for debugging. The MI, the inverter, and the DTU, they are communicating via a proprietary RF interface. And a heartbeat mechanism is used in this interface. I added an out-of-band communication to, and the MI detects when the heartbeat interface stops, and after 5 minutes, it goes in the unlocked function. And in this unlocked function, all interrupts will be switched off, and the watchdog too, and we will configure some pin, and we want to toggle the grid side relay. This is a typical picture or architecture picture of an inverter. So on the left side, you see we have a DC-DC converter. The solar sides feed energy into this DC-DC converter. Then we have the so-called edge bridge, which transforms the DC energy, the DC electricity, in AC electricity. We have a filter, and then we have the grid side relay and a fuse. You can also note that the DSP controls almost all the power electronics directly, transistors and relay. The DSP is connected via an UART channel to an RF module on board, and this RF module is connected then to the DTU via this proprietary RF protocol. And on the right, you see also a picture of the PCB, so I can show you, but you see it better on the picture, right? The DSP is here, we have transistors here, or they are broken on this one, and here we have also big MOSFETs, and the grid side relay, right? The most important part. Okay, the shellcode. Yeah. The shellcode was divided into different functions, and I needed a global variable cross functions. And instead of going into SRAM, because I didn't know where the SRAM mapping was quite complicated, I decided to go for a peripheral register which was free. And ironically, I used this code security module, which is a security feature of the DSP, which was not used by the vendor. And I stored my global variable into a peripheral, into a register of this code security module. At initialization time, we will initialize the X with a constant. Then each time a data is received by the UART, you remember the UART channel between RF module and DSP. So each time a data is received, we increment X. And in a recurring timer interrupt, we'll decrement X. And if X is less than a constant, then we branch to the unlocked function. And in the unlocked function, we switch off interrupts and we toggle the grid side relay GPIO. On the right side, you see an excerpt of the C code for the unlocked function, which has been compiled into machine code, transformed into Intel hex format. Then I copied some part of the Intel hex into an update image. I had to craft a valid update image with all the headers and CSS, but there is no cryptographic signature, so it was possible. OK, now we can test our POC. For the sake of better demonstration, the screenshots and the video, I did them post-patch. So it's only possible to execute the update command on an own registered inverter. And I redirected the get command from the device to the update to the update server with DNS mask to an own internal HTTP server. And this is also possible because no TLS is in place, so no need to mess up with any root CA here. The DTU was programmed to stop operation at exactly 12 p.m. On the bottom of this slide, you see the setup again. On the solar side, a power supply to power the electronics. On the grid side, a small signal generator, an oscilloscope. The MI is connected via the RF protocol with the DTU. The DTU is connected via Wi-Fi to the PC. And in the PC, we have DNS mask or HTTP server, and it is connected to the internet. This is the initial state of the POC. On the top, you see the grid side, the oscilloscope picture with the small signal, so the sinus, 5 volt peak to peak. On the right side, a picture of the system, a clock. Then man-in-the-middle proxy that just to monitor the traffic, the HTTP server. On the right bottom, we will send the command to the cloud. First, we send a command to update the MI, so the inverter. So we send a command, the update command, you remember this update command with a serial number of the MI to the cloud. The cloud sends a command to the associated DTU to fetch the update image. And you see on the man-in-the-middle proxy and on the HTTP server that there is a get command from the DTU, and the DTU gets the image from our internal HTTP server. And then it transmits this image to the MI, and then the MI installs this image. We can do exactly the same for the DTU, meaning we send a command to the cloud with a DTU serial number. Then the DTU will fetch its update image, redirect it to our internal HTTP server. And then the DTU will just install this image because all the CRCs are correct. And exactly at 12 p.m., the DTU stops operation. All LEDs goes on. And what we cannot see, but what is important for the next slide, is that the heartbeat mechanism also stops. So remember, we stopped everything, stop interrupt, stop everything. Which means that after 5 minutes, the MI goes into the unlock function, and you can see it clearly on the oscilloscope picture that we have the grid side relay toggles every 200 milliseconds, I guess. And also the LEDs are switched on. And I think now I have some videos. So let's begin with the DTU. In that case, it was programmed to stop at exactly 2:30, so 14:30. Let's see. Hey, yes. We match. And now, yeah, this is a little bit of a mess, but now let's have a look at the MI. So we have on the top the inverter. On the bottom, I had to grab my old Tektronix with a grid side relay, the small signal generator, the power supply. And you see the DTU on the right has already stopped, so it's about 5 minutes after the DTU stops. Let's see what happens. You can see on the picture, but you can also hear, I amplified the sound a little bit, you can also hear the grid side relay toggling. So we manage also after 5 minutes after the, 5 minutes after the DTU stops to manipulate the behavior of the inverter. Now, as I said, basically, other behaviors could be programmed in the device too. And here, I programmed another unlock function, and this unlocked version 2 or whatever you want. I wanted to see how fast we can heat the device. Now, transforming electricity into heat is not very complicated, right? So I changed the pulse width modulation on the solar side, so you see the device draws more current from the solar side. And I also changed the behavior of the grid side, the transistor on the grid side. And you see on the top right of this slide of this video that the device consumes about 25 watts. That's not much. But enough to heat the transistors. And on the right, in the bottom, you see a temperature sensor, which has connected to a probe to the case. And it's already like 33 degrees Celsius. So the device is already in unlocked mode when this video begins. As I said, I wanted to see how fast we can hit the device. But something unexpected happened. Now you see the temperature increases. Okay. Let's see. What's that? Ah. Okay. And that's what I call IT-OT convergence. Or better said, the security implications of the IT-OT convergence. Now, what happened here? Basically, it's not so simply possible to short-circuit the grid by switching off MOSFETs on this device because there is a short-circuit protection circuitry. However, and despite of this protection, the MOSFET broke down, probably because they were overheated locally. And you know, if MOSFETs break down, they tend to short-circuit drain and source. And that's what happened here, and that's why we add this short circuit on the grid. Okay, let's go back to the presentation. Now let's step back and see what could happen with this kind of exploit. By silently updating multiple devices in advance with malicious firmware images, a synchronous behavior change of many, many devices could be triggered. And this kind of synchronous behavior change is not very good for the grid. And it is stated here in a study from Netherlands, turning off all the converters at once and turning them on again, you will get spikes. Not good. Moreover, devices could be bricked. I think you saw that in the last video. And shame on me, I don't want to produce too much electronics waste, right? But it happened. I didn't want to. Devices could be also overheated by changing the pulse width modulation parameters. And many safety measures or countermeasures in this device are controlled by the firmware. And since we control the firmware, yeah, that's not good. And last but not least, the DTU could be misused for criminal activities like botnet or whatever, because it has a direct internet connection, and it can be also reprogrammed. I disclosed this vulnerability to the BSC first, and then I waited again, and then I contacted Heise, and then things went very fast, and the manufacturer patched the most critical vulnerability. Okay. Now, as I said, I had a look at more devices, and here I can present some of the results. Okay, let's begin with the cloud and API vulnerabilities. Insecure direct object reference, 4 out of 4. So here, manipulating parameters on a remote device with a simple account or executing commands on a remote device, again, with a simple account. That was possible. Information disclosure, 4 out of 4. Here, serial numbers, like in this one, but also mail addresses, GPS coordinates. And in one device, interestingly, it was possible to extract or to get the SSID and the associated Wi-Fi password of the Wi-Fi with which the device is connected remotely. And yeah, what could I say? Privilege escalation. I tested only one platform, and it was so simple to get super admin rights. And that was very scary, and I stopped because I didn't want to mess up with the cloud platform and to end up in jail. So, yeah, but anyway, let's go to the device-to-cloud communication security. Here we have TLS for, 2 out of 4, not bad. But only one implemented it correctly, meaning the other one, they didn't check the server certificate. That's bad. And from one of the non-TLS devices, I was very curious because they said, yeah, we have encryption. And I had a look at it, and they have an interesting encryption mechanism. They have an XOR function with a repetitive constant string. So that's better than all modern cryptography, right? And okay, my expectation, but maybe I have very high expectation, right? That will have to be MTLS, so TLS with mutual authentication, client-side, server-side, with an individual client certificate. And yeah, none of them implemented that. But a lot of client-side security checks, right? And they are quite useless. The embedded part was also interesting because here nothing was done. So JTAG interfaces were open. Okay, that's good for me. Flash protection, even if the semiconductors, the CPU or the DSP, even if they have some security protection measures in place, they were not used. Secure boot was not implemented, but again, a lot of checksums, CRC, whatever. Secure update, here also, cryptographic signature unknown, so all the devices had only like CRCs, or for one device they at least like encrypt the binary, but it was an hard-coded key which you can't find in the app code, so also not very good. Now, the question is, do we have a systematic problem? I cannot say for sure, because I had only a look at four devices, and I'm quite sure there are vendors doing a very good job regarding security, right? And I do not want to blame the whole industry. Nevertheless, I will recommend you not to connect or to disconnect your solar power plant from the vendor's cloud. I think that's safe. And yeah, now, I mean, how to get out of this mess? My message here is not to say I need to go back to the old system and centralize and smoke and whatever. No. The path is clear. We need to democratize our energy production. But I mean, if we connect all our small solar inverters or power plants to few vendors, we are going to re-centralize a decentralized system, right? With all the security implications which you saw in this slide. That's why we need open source solutions. And for this particular device, there are open source solutions available in an interesting case. There is this OpenDTU and this Ahoy DTU, I don't know how to pronounce it. And I think we need to go there, right? To have, in order to take back the control over our systems. That's the message. Because if we want to wait, if we want to wait until we have regulations, then we can wait very, very, very long, I guess. Because these devices are classified as commercial IoT devices. And for them, there is almost nothing. In Germany, we have the Kritis Verordnung, the Kritis Decree, which applies for big power plants, more than 104 megawatts, so not for all small power plants. However, if we sum the power of all the small power plants connected to one cloud, I guess we'll reach this number by now, and maybe it shall apply. But I don't know, right? I'm not in this stuff. And we have the EU Cyber Resilience Act. This will save us, right? I know it is controversial, but at least it will apply to this device. However, this regulation shall apply 36 months. I don't know why they changed to 36, but that's not good. I mean, in 3 years, and the conformity assessments can be, for this kind of device, as far as I understood, can be a self-assessment, right? So you don't need to go to a third party to evaluate your system. So I think we need a more effective short-term solution in terms of regulation. And this leads me to my conclusion. What did we see in this talk? We have electricity power production system, which is now going to be decentralized. We have a lot of connected power plants, especially solar power plants. We saw what could happen if some players enter the market with, let's say, less security backgrounds. Yeah, for the last one, I think I don't have to elaborate. That's why I would encourage the community here to have a look at devices in the energy sectors, like inverter, but also EV charger, wall boxes, or smart meters. But be careful with electricity, right? I hope you enjoyed this talk. That's the end, and maybe we have questions.
Thank you, Sebastian. We have roughly 5 minutes left for questions, and I would give the first one to the signal angel. If you have questions in the room, please line up at the microphones to ask your question. Single Angel.
The internet is asking what kind of regulation would help with this?
Sorry, I didn't get?
What kind of regulation would help to address this issue?
So I think the CRA goes in the right direction, right? Because the CRA will apply to many devices in this sector, to all commercial IoT devices. However, I think it would be good to classify these devices as critical devices so that we have a little bit more, that we have at least a third-party evaluation of the device. But I think the CRA is good, but it's only in 3 years, right? So I don't know what happens. In 3 years, many things can happen.
Thank you. If you leave the room, please do that more quietly. Thank you. Microphone number one, your question, please.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for your great presentation. You went much further than we did. I'm from DFID. We hacked the solar panels, and you just showed the article. I have a very ethical question for you. If you want to check on these crappy devices that people put in their homes, you need to check their homes, right? And that's a dilemma that we got. You know, we proved that these devices can be hacked, but then all the network managers in the Netherlands said, well, if we need to check these devices, we need to go into their homes to see what they're using, and then you invade the privacy of the people. So what is your standpoint on balancing the security of the network, because if you switch them on and off, you can get a blackout, or governing the privacy of the citizens and not going to their energy supply?
I think the answer is quite simple, right? We need to have devices which have a state-of-the-art security. And then I don't think we have any privacy problem. It's because if we have a devices out of the box which has proper security, then you don't need to go to the people, to their network. That's my understanding, right?
People buy the cheapest one and they don't have security.
Yeah, but that's why we need also a kind of standard and regulation, because obviously, if there is no standard, there will be always such kind of problems.
Yeah, but regulations need to be checked, and then you need to invade people's home.
Yeah, but you can check the regulations also on some samples or own devices or whatever, right? You don't need to go to people's home.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
I don't understand you.
You do.
Okay.
Okay. Well, just leave you with that.
All right. Single Angel, is there another question from the internet?
One more minute.
Do you think the vulnerabilities were like backdoors?
No. No. It's lack of security maturity, let's say.
Thank you. Microphone number four, your question.
I saw in your inverter schematic there was actually a thyristor on the high side. Why is there a thyristor instead of a normal MOSFET?
That's a good question. I cannot answer. I had exactly the same suit, right? No idea. Maybe cheaper or better characteristic. That's a good question, but I cannot answer that. Sorry.
Okay. Thank you. Microphone number two, what is your question?
Yeah. I have one question, so thanks for your talk. So you really showed that the normal DTU by Homolds is just shit and you should use the Ahoy DTU.
Yes.
Thanks for this. I think everybody uses it. You had a pretty good demonstration of how the security is crappy between the normal DTU and the cloud. So, but what is the security between the converter itself and any other device? I mean, the only thing what I need is a serial number, which is basically on a sticker on the back of the inverter, and that's it. So have you also had a look at that one and how the security measures can be improved there?
You mean the proprietary RF protocol between DTU and inverter?
Yes, correct, which is basically open source right now.
It's open source and it's not secure.
Yeah.
However, you need to be in radio proximity to misuse it. But that's a good point. I mean, there is nothing. On the other hand, it's a dilemma, right? Because if they put much more security, then you cannot use the open DTU. So yeah, that's a problem. But I think this proprietary RF protocol is not secure at all.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think we're out of time. Thank you, Sebastian, for your interesting talk. Please give him a huge round of applause.